Cybersecurity is not a new challenge. But in the 1970s and 1980s, what we call computer viruses were seldom costly problems. They were mostly just experiments written in labs, harmless pranks, nuisances. But as the internet continued to evolve, so did those viruses and the motives of the people who created them. Some viruses were written for fame, some for fortune. Some were made to be weapons targeting infrastructure, institutions, or industry. It's no surprise, then, that cybersecurity became a top issue during the recent U.S. presidential election. At a speech in Virginia just a month before Election Day, then-candidate Donald Trump outlined the challenge.
The scope of our cybersecurity problem is enormous. Our government, our businesses, our trade secrets, and our citizens' most sensitive information are all facing constant cyber attacks and reviews by the enemy. Just consider some of these recent hacks. JP Morgan Chase, massive bank, had 73 million emails stolen. eBay was involved and gave up 150 million passwords. Target was attacked and gave up 40 million credit card numbers. Attacks like these are happening on a regular basis, both in the United States and around the world. And the costs in terms of privacy, our security, and our financial sector are truly extraordinary. Identity theft, financial laundering, as well as ransom and ransomware. I mean, think of it. All involving extortion of a hacked institution are becoming increasingly common. And they are extorting institutions.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the challenges that President-elect Trump will face after Inauguration Day on January 20, 2017. On this show, we talk about the issues that Mr. Trump will find at the top of his inbox when he arrives in the Oval Office. We're going to discuss what he has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. This week, we're going to talk about cybersecurity. How will President-elect Trump handle those priorities during his administration?
And with us this week to help examine those priorities is CFR's Adam Siegel and Robert Konecki. Adam is the director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program and author of The Hacked World Order, How Nations Fight, Trade, Maneuver, and Manipulate in the Digital Age. Rob's a senior fellow focusing on cybersecurity policy and internet governance, and he comes from the White House, where for 3 years he worked at the National Security Council as director for cybersecurity policy. Before we begin, I want to roll another clip from the same speech President-elect Trump gave in Virginia. He gave a sample of his plan for cybersecurity.
Cyber theft is the fastest growing crime in the United States by far. As president, improving cybersecurity will be an immediate and top priority for my administration. One of the very first things I will do is to order a thorough review of our cyber defenses and weaknesses. We have very substantial weaknesses, including all vital infrastructure.
So given this emphasis in the speech, especially on infrastructure and cyber defenses, Adam, could you start off by telling us what this says about this administration's priorities and how you assess them?
Well, first of all, he's unlikely to discover anything new in a review. We've known what the problems are. President Obama had a cybersecurity review in his first 60 days of office, and the presidential cybersecurity commission just reported to the president at the very end of his commission. And what a review would find is that critical infrastructure is vulnerable to destructive attacks, that the power grid, financial sector, transportation are all vulnerable, that we don't have the right incentives in place for the private sector to increase its investment, that we've failed to create a deterrent from having either nation states or non-state actors attack us in cyberspace, that we need to do more collaboration and cooperation with our international partners. So we know what the problems are. I think the real question and the uncertainty is going to be how President Trump is going to address those problems.
And is there a issue of sort of where he should be focusing resources on addressing these problems? I mean, you laid out a really strong range and kind of a troubling range of problems.
Well, I think most people think the priorities are going to be critical infrastructure, right? Any attack that could destroy or disrupt power grid, in particular but also the financial sector and transportation. Those are all serious strategic and economic threats to the United States. Those are areas where government regulation could have some impact in getting the private sector to raise its cybersecurity level. And it's an area where we've had some progress on information sharing, on the sharing of threat intelligence between critical infrastructure operators and the U.S. government.
Rob, can I draw you out on this challenge of protecting critical infrastructure? I think Adam said a nice job of laying out for us what we mean by critical infrastructure. For people listening to this podcast, can you give people a sense of what kind of attack we might experience and what the consequences should be? I mean, because obviously if you watch TV shows, you can get some pretty alarming scenarios, but I don't know how serious to take those. So maybe you give people, since you've sort of done the issue from the inside, what kind of concerns we have?
Sure, Jim. I think the greatest concern is an attack on the power grid. In the United States, we consider 16 sectors of the economy to be critical, but all those sectors and everything we do depends on electric power in the modern age. And so the big fear has been an attack on our power system. What we've seen over the years, going back to 2008, the CIA warned that foreign actors had taken down power grids overseas on at least one occasion. We then saw reports coming out of the DNI's office. The Director of National Intelligence, that Chinese and Russian hackers were attempting to infiltrate our power grid and doing what we call preparation of the battlefield, planning for the day when they might want to take down our power grid when geopolitical circumstances would make that something that they would think would be in their interest. What I think has really gotten people scared over the last year is that in December of 2015, the Russians allegedly did take down the power grid in parts of Ukraine. They actually used a cyber attack to cause a blackout. And so what had been fact, rumor, and surmise, what had been science fiction, turned out to be real and to be something that the U.S. is probably more vulnerable to than a country like Ukraine, because we are so digitized and so dependent on this infrastructure.
Now, are we worried about blackouts that last 20 minutes, half an hour? Or are we talking about blackouts that could last days?
So there's two extremes here. On one end, you have fears of a multi-month-long blackout over a large region of the United States. This is what Ted Koppel put forward in his book, Lights Out. I think that is an exaggerated circumstance under which we have total collapse of society. But more reasonable, more sober assessments from Lloyd's of London have said very, very reasonable to look at a 24-hour, a week-long blackout, multi-week-long in certain parts of the country that would cost us billions of dollars and have a tremendous impact on the economy.
So civilian infrastructure, obviously the power grid, a crucial vulnerability. What about, as you expand it a little bit more, you know, institutions, government institutions, and so forth? Homeland Security is one of the primary departments handling this, but it's broader than that, isn't it?
It's absolutely broader than that. I think you raised two interesting points. One, I think the biggest thing that the Trump transition team is looking at right now and needs to be looking at right now is how to protect the federal government from cyber attack, how to prevent another Office of Personnel Management breach, which we saw in the Obama administration, how to keep sensitive data secure, and how to make sure operations can continue even when there is a cyber attack underway. So I think that's got to be goal number one. On the question of how the government can protect the power grid or other critical infrastructure, that's still a little bit of an open question. Right now, that responsibility largely lies with the private sector owners and operators of the infrastructure.
Well, it's important to point out most of our critical infrastructure is owned by the private sector. Correct, Rob?
Correct. I mean, the number that has been out there for years is 85% is owned by the private sector. For critical infrastructure that could be targeted by a cyber attack, it's probably higher than that. So this is fundamentally a private sector problem. Then the question becomes, how does the Department of Homeland Security help them protect themselves? How does Cyber Command at the Department of Defense help them protect themselves? And how do all these entities work together?
And how have we done it so far? What was the Obama administration's approach to that challenge? I know there's a lot of talk about public-private partnerships. Maybe you could parse that out for us. That would be great.
Sure. So I always treated this as the Home Depot model. You can do it. We can help, right? Where it was government's job to say, here's what we expect. Here are the standards, either voluntary or regulatory. Here's the tools we're going to give you. We're going to give you the NIST cybersecurity framework, which sets out those requirements very clearly. We're going to give you information. We're going to commit to making sure that if we have intelligence that you need to protect your company, you get it, that the FBI will come knocking on your door and tell you that you've been targeted or you've already been breached. And we will use diplomacy, we will use law enforcement, and on a very bad day, we will send cyber command out into cyberspace to shut down an attack coming from overseas. So that was, I think, fundamentally the approach of the Obama administration. Whether that remains the approach of the Trump administration, I don't know yet.
There was useful testimony from Eric Rosenbach, who at the time was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for cyber, who basically kind of answered both your questions about, you know, what type of threats we should be concerned about and what the Defense Department's role would be, where he basically said, you know, the Defense Department is only going to get involved in the 1-2% of the attacks that we think have the potential to cause destruction. Right. So the vast majority of the attacks that were happening out there are espionage or website defacements or distributed denial of services when you knock a website off. So the Defense Department is only going to come to the defense of critical infrastructure in the private sector in these very, very small number of attacks that have a very, very small likelihood of causing massive destruction or disruption.
Or as well as U.S. military installations or like the nuclear facilities and things like that.
Well, DOD is always going to defend .mil, right? So the military network. So its responsibilities, Cyber Command's responsibilities are essentially to defend .mil. To provide offensive capabilities in case the U.S. wants to use its own cyber capacities. And if asked by the U.S. government to defend private sector under very specific legal concerns.
Adam, I don't want to ask Rob to grade his own homework, so I want to ask this question to you. Obviously, Donald Trump, in the clip we heard at the top of the podcast, said that he was going to make cybersecurity a priority, which seems to imply that the Obama administration didn't make it a priority. Are there steps, from your point of view, that a Trump administration is likely to take that an Obama administration has declined to take in this area of cybersecurity?
I don't think so. I think, you know, the Obama administration can probably point and say they have been the most active in this space. If you look at the number of executive orders and changes to Defense Department strategy, they did get a huge amount accomplished. The only problem is that nobody thinks we're better off or better defended. We have certainly made, I think, marginal improvements in information sharing and, as Rob said, the NIST framework, the National Institute of Science and Technology Standards, is an important set of guidelines for the private sector about how to defend themselves. I think the Trump administration has so far kind of framed itself, it's going to be more muscular in this space, right? They've talked a lot about offensive capabilities. But one, I think, you know, we know that under the Obama administration, Cyber Command and cyberspace is one of three areas in the Defense Department that has not been affected by budget cuts, along with special operations and drones. We know Cyber Command itself has gone from about 1,000 to 5,000 personnel. And the Trump administration is going to face many of the same limitations that the Obama administration did, which is one, how do you demonstrate to your potential adversaries that you have an offensive cyber capability? Because once you use a cyber attack, it's not clear you can use it again. In fact,
okay, but you've just now changed the terrain we're talking about. Before, we were talking about how to protect private sector assets because we're worried about critical infrastructure coming down. Now we're talking about launching an offensive attack. So maybe I take a step back. When would you launch an offensive attack from something like Cyber Command? What's the purpose of such an attack?
But I think they're connected in the sense that many people think the defense is never going to catch up with the offense, right? So no matter what regulations you put in place, no matter how much defense you get in place, because cyberspace is inherently offense advantage, that you have to deter an attack. And the way you have to deter an attack is through offensive capabilities.
So the best defense is good offense.
The best defense is good offense. So that's where I think the Trump administration is going to make this pivot between what we were talking about with critical infrastructure and offensive capabilities.
So are you suggesting that that the United States government will, to prevent an attack on a electrical power grid in some part of the United States, go after the electrical power grid of some other country? I mean, I'm trying to understand how this dynamic of going on the offense works, because one way of looking at it is not that you're going to deter an attack, you're going to guarantee an attack because someone's going to retaliate. How does this all work?
Yeah, I think so. One, there is the question about can you deter others since we are more vulnerable? But I think the thinking is either, yes, you hold what they value at risk in a normal kind of deterrent framework, or you in fact dismantle the infrastructure, the computer network infrastructure that they have to launch those attacks. So you would, in many ways, what was called, is called active defense, right? You defend outside of U.S. networks, which means attacking routers and other things in other countries to prevent them from launching those attacks.
Well, that means you're snooping around or you are present in other people's networks, which in and of itself, I don't know whether that qualifies as espionage or a crime or something else. I mean, Rob used the phrase preparing the battlefield, which sounds to me like you're talking about is the United States preparing the battlefield.
So if you look at how the U.S. government has reacted to reports of cyber intrusions into things like the power grid, it's been pretty muted. And I think the reason for that is you can guess that the U.S. government is doing the same thing. And so we haven't necessarily pushed for a norm that would say we are against any kind of exploration or infiltration into critical infrastructure. What we've pushed for is a norm against using that kind of access to disrupt critical infrastructure in peacetime. So that's been the approach that the Obama administration has taken on this issue. I could very well see the Trump administration declaring that any attempt to gain access to our critical infrastructure will be treated as a hostile act. The question is, would we want that same standard applied back to us, or do we get some value out of potentially holding other countries' infrastructure at risk as they hold our infrastructure at risk? It starts to look very much like a traditional Cold War scenario of deterrence.
We've talked at this point on the assumption that we're dealing with other state actors, but it seems that in the issue of cybersecurity, you worry not just about other state actors, but you worry about non-state actors. And again, I'm not a computer scientist, so I'm not sure how difficult some of these attacks are. But how does the potential of groups that are not states in and of themselves or may have a relationship with a state but may also be distant from a state, how does that factor into how you play deterrence? Because this is obviously a challenge in dealing with terrorists. They don't generally hold territory that you can, you know, put at harm's risk, so they can be very difficult to deter.
So right after 9/11, there was this tremendous fear that terrorists were going to discover the internet and start carrying out attacks over the internet on critical infrastructure. And for the last decade or more, that really hasn't come to pass. Terrorists tend to use the internet for everything that modern corporations use the internet for. They use it to recruit, they use it to train, they use it to organize, but they've largely left the use of offensive cyber capability to states. And probably because I think we tend to underestimate the difficulty of carrying out a month's or multi-year planning cycle to do something like take down the power grid. And if you are ISIS and you are figuring out, do I want to expend my efforts in actually maintaining territory in the Middle East, or do I want to expend my efforts and my money carrying out a cyber attack against the United States? I think it's pretty clear where they've come down thus far. The evidence of any kind of major terrorist activity on the internet aimed at disrupting critical infrastructure just isn't there.
So in terms of state actors, though, it seems to begin and end, at least initially, with Russia and China. Is that correct to say?
Well, when I think of potential adversaries, we also would consider North Korea has shown itself very capable. Iran is clearly moving up capabilities. Israel, the UK, France, Germany are all also going to be very capable players. I think the other issue we have, right, is nation states using non-state actors or appearing to use non-state actors. And so, you know, when we had...
Well, the Chinese and Russians have been accused of this, correct?
Exactly. So
And the Sony hack had some murkiness to it, too.
Exactly. In the Sony hack, they claim that they were called the Guardians of Peace. And with the DNC hacking, the hacking of the Democratic National Committee, originally, you know, we had somebody calling himself Guccifer 2.0, claiming responsibility, but then the U.S. intelligence agency saying, no, we think Russian state actors were behind the attack. So that makes it even harder to deter, because even if you can pick out the individual groups that are behind it, understanding their motivation or trying to figure out what to hold at value, hold at risk, is one step or two step removed from what the leadership might be thinking.
Just to be clear, this is a factual question. The United States hasn't committed itself to the proposition that if you attack us in cyberspace, we will restrict our response to cyberspace. I mean, we in essence argue that all tools are on the table. We could attack you in cyberspace or use kinetic force, as they like to say in the military.
That's absolutely correct. And that's been a position going from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration and through the Obama administration. The U.S. government has been very clear on that point and very clear that the response will come in a time and a manner of our choosing, and that it will not necessarily be an instantaneous response in cyberspace.
Well, then it becomes quite complicated if the attack can't be clearly attributed to a state actor, but to some in this gray zone where we assert that they are acting on behalf of a government and the government in question says, don't know them at all.
So what we've seen so far, at least in the last, I would say, 5 years or so, is an incredible ability by U.S. law enforcement, by private sector companies that do cybersecurity forensics, and by the intelligence community to attribute cyber attacks not to a nation, not to an organization, not even to a building, but down to the individual fingers that were on the keyboard, being able to produce their photos, being able to produce their names, their online hacker handles, and being able to present the evidence as to who they are and why they carried out this attack. So we've gotten pretty good at that. I think where the criminal world and the intersection of the state world really gets complicated is at this point, the capabilities of some of these criminal groups are as good, if not surpassing, the capabilities of the best nation states out there. And I think if there was one thing that I would say is a major emerging challenge for the Trump administration, it's how do you handle global organized crime that is not attached to the nation state? The Obama administration was very focused on Chinese criminal activity that was backed by the state. What are you going to do when you have groups that are not necessarily affiliated with the state, that are only out for commercial gain, and might do something like take over the power grid and threaten to take it down as the ultimate ransomware attack?
Before we sort of go to that, it actually sounds like the plot of a Hollywood movie or two I've seen, but you're not reassuring me by suggesting that it could happen. I take your point, Robert, how good the U.S. government has gone at trying to figure out who's conducted attacks. And that is, if you're really working on trying to solve what we call the attribution problem. But to really solve the attribution problem, you have to not only be able to figure out who's done it, but to persuade other people that the evidence you found is credible. And that can be very difficult to do. A case in point is Donald Trump, who was quite critical when he was candidate Trump in arguing that, contrary to what the U.S. intelligence agency said, Russian-sponsored hackers were not responsible for the hacks on the Democratic National Committee's emails. Here's a clip for Mr. Trump from one of the debates.
I don't think anybody knows it was Russia that broke into the DNC. She's saying Russia, 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 but I don't, maybe it was. I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay? You don't know who broke in to DNC.
So I would say we can have confidence that it was not a campaign carried out by a 400-pound hacker sitting on his bed at home. This was definitely the work at least of multiple people in an organized and sustained campaign. And I think we can take the word of the 17 IC agencies that, in fact, it indeed was carried out by Russia. I can understand why during the campaign, candidate Trump wouldn't have wanted to admit that Russia was, in fact, trying to impact the election on his side. Now I think the challenge for President Trump is going to be to keep other foreign nations from interfering in any future U.S. elections. We saw Russian interference. We did not see Chinese interference. You can make a very credible case that China, looking at what happened this time, looking at the direction that trade is moving in, looking at their interests, might say, God, we cannot let this man get reelected. And so for that reason, I think he's going to have to find a way to admit, yes, Russia was behind it, and take some very stark measures to keep Russia from involving itself in U.S. politics ever again.
Well, I'll note, Rob, that candidate Trump made the argument that he couldn't see evidence that Russian hackers had gone after the DNC's emails. But President-elect Trump, in his interview to Time when he was named Man of the Year, doubled down on that claim, I believe, and said that he didn't believe the Russians were responsible. But, you know, this gets us back into the issue you just raised, or the broader thing of governments using social media, fake news, leaking emails to try to influence democracies. I mean, Adam, you've written a book, The Hack World Order, which talks a bit about this. Can you sort of walk us through what we think we know about these efforts?
In the case of the hacking of the Democratic National Committee and then in the emails of Clinton campaign chair Jump Desta, we see that the taking of emails and other data and then releasing them through websites and through pushing them out through WikiLeaks, and what appears to be either an effort to, you know, tilt the election towards Trump, or I think more likely just, quite honestly, to sow chaos and confusion and create an atmosphere where there is a large degree of distrust in facts and in the institutions of democracy. We've seen Russia do this before to some of its neighbors. And we know that, you know, one of the issues with cyberspace and cyber attacks is that, you know, we started at the beginning of the program, we were a lot focused on kind of, as you said, movie script kind of attacks that take out power grids and cause destructions. But the way that nation states have tended to use cyber is as much a tool as influence as it is of disruption and destruction. So they see a great deal of efficacy and political use in trying to shape information and outlooks in states both close by and far away. And it really stretches our conception both of kind of, you know, war and peace. So these things happen in peacetime. There's no dividing line between when there's conflict and when there isn't. And what the targets are, right? You know, as Rob said at the beginning, we had 16 areas of the U.S. economy that considered critical infrastructure. Sony, as movie producing, would have not necessarily fallen out of that. But that was one of the areas, one of the first areas where the U.S. attributed an attack to a state-based attacker. We sanctioned the North Koreans, and the U.S. government, you know, got very involved in deterring and attributing that attack.
So given what's at stake here in terms of the cost to private companies, things like power grids, national elections, what have you, to what extent are countries coming together and talking about sort of norms here to try to deal with the governance in this space? It seems like it's off to a pretty rocky start.
Well, Rob alluded to there's been a discussion at the United Nations through a group called the Group of Government Experts on Information and Communication Technologies. They identified four norms of behavior, one of them which is to not disrupt critical infrastructure during peacetime. But what disrupt means is unclear. What critical infrastructure means is unclear. And, you know, as we saw from the DNC and other hacks, that's not necessarily exactly what states are doing. So there's still lots of space to move in there. The Russians actually this week just released a new information security doctrine, which talks a lot about this kind of weaponization of social media and how do you defend against that. So they have a broader kind of conception about what conflict in cyberspace means, but that's going to be a very difficult space for states to agree on, because what we see as the free flow of information and freedom of speech, they're going to see as attacks on regime legitimacy and domestic stability.
Are we going to be able to see any coalescence among Western democratic nations on this issue of the weaponization of social media? I ask because it's not just the United States that is worried about fake news being spread and information being leaked by other countries to influence an election. We're clearly seeing evidence of that across Western Europe. Is there any sort of talk among, let's say, NATO on how to handle this? And if so, how do you respond to the fact that a foreign power may be generating fake news with the aim of trying to tip the balance in an election?
The difficulty here is obviously that stopping fake news is a form of censorship. And the U.S. government in the Obama administration has focused all their efforts on maintaining an open, interoperable, secure, and reliable internet, right? The idea that we want to allow the free flow of information and that governments shouldn't get in the way of their citizens communicating with each other and communicating with citizens in other countries and receiving news sources from anywhere in the world. That's obviously not a position that is popular in every country. It is certainly a position that China has taken a firm stand against and essentially tried to wall off their piece of cyberspace so that they could restrict what their citizens interact with in the Western world. And I think we're likely to see more of that in China, more of that in Russia. And increasingly, I think that there's a real risk that that kind of action will become popular in some of our allied states in Europe.
I think it's very likely that we will. I think there's already been some work across NATO about how do you fight disinformation. So, you know, most of that has just been on Twitter and Facebook itself, with, you know, kind of publishing counter narratives or what they see as the facts. But I think if you look what's happening in countering violent extremism online, where there's a lot more pressure on the companies themselves to come up with technological solutions. Twitter, Facebook, and others announced that they would come up with some kind of technological solutions to marking some materials as being violent extremism and marked for takedown, that we're going to probably see something similar for fake news as well.
I think that the disturbing trend here, what has some people a little bit worried, is comments that President-elect Trump made recently, where he essentially said, we've got to figure out how to shut down parts of the internet that ISIS are using to recruit and train and organize, and that he was going to talk to Bill Gates about how to do that. Now, I think a lot of people said, that's funny. We didn't know Bill Gates had the kill switch for the internet. But it really raises up a question of, are we likely to see, for instance, the use of Cyber Command to shut down internet activity in parts of the world where there is this kind of coordination among terrorist groups going on?
So in closing, Adam, Rob, how about a piece of advice for the incoming administration on cybersecurity?
My basic piece of advice would be, don't start over. The Obama administration was able to build on the final initiatives in the last year of the Bush administration to great success. I think that there are pieces of what the Obama administration has done that President Trump can build on. Throwing everything out and starting with a new strategy and a clean slate is probably not going to end up making the United States more secure. Instead, I think it's important to continue to work with the private sector to address the known problems that we have and to come up with new solutions to them, but build on top of this concept that we've been nurturing for 20 years of a public-private partnership for cybersecurity.
Yeah, I think mine is to prioritize. I think there's a kind of a tendency to group lots of problems together. And as Rob was mentioning at the beginning of the program, I think getting the power grid defended is probably our most important goal in the beginning and stages of the administration, followed by the financial sector. I think there's a lot of worry that the attack that comes will be one that manipulates data in small ways, but just enough to undermine our credibility and our belief in it. So those two areas would be my first areas of focus. And I think, as Rob said, there's lots of ideas on the table already about how to strengthen them.
And on those notes of advice, we'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. Adam, Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Be sure to subscribe to the President's Inbox in iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick and recording engineers Glenn Goldman and Dan Mudd. We give special thanks to Audrey Boulder. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on the President's Inbox.